This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Ohio voters go to the polls in little more than a month. With John Kasich term limited out, the seat is open and competition on both the Republican and Democratic sides is intense, and in some cases, personal and bitter. To size up the gubernatorial contest, we are joined today by Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call us at 513-419-7100 or email talk@WVXU. And we are also on Twitter and Facebook. Joe, Howard, welcome to the show today.
Great to be with you.
Let's just start with the Republican side of what's going on here. Two major candidates, Mike DeWine, Mary Taylor. Mike DeWine, well-known, been in a lot of different positions over the last four-plus decades. Mary Taylor, currently the lieutenant governor, but probably not as well-known. This race has gotten very nasty. Joe, what's your analysis of why this has gone as bitter as it's gone, as quick as it's happened?
Well, you know, this is a very hard-fought race right now because Mary Taylor's been the lieutenant governor the whole time through the Kasich era. And, you know, lieutenant governors typically think, oh, they're in line for to be governor at some point. And Mike DeWine is very well-known, very, like you said, very key part of the party. So he has a lot of alliances. He has a lot of support. And the party itself has given him a lot of support, a lot of key endorsements. Although Mary Taylor has gotten some endorsements from Tea Party groups and some office holders as well. But the thing that Mary Taylor doesn't have is she doesn't have the widespread name recognition that DeWine has. And she also doesn't have his money. He has a lot of money in the bank and she doesn't have as much. And I think the thing that really is causing a lot of this consternation is that there are no debates on the Republican side. So she doesn't have a platform or an opportunity to bring up issues and debate them in the kind of environment where she could actually talk about these things and draw differences between her and Mike DeWine.
So Howard,
Mike DeWine has not chosen to debate her, and there have been offers of debates. Right. They haven't come through, and that's become a campaign issue in and of itself.
Yeah, Howard, on a strictly campaign strategy point of view, why should Mike DeWine debate Mary Taylor? He's got seemingly an advantage.
There's no reason whatsoever, none. I mean, there's not much public polling out there. There was this one survey, USA poll, that had him at 50% and her at 18%. You know, if he's leading by those kind of numbers at this point in the campaign, why give her a platform? He doesn't want to give her a platform. And it's so much easier to have attack ads and put 30-second attack ads up on TV where you call your opponent names rather than stand on a stage with him or her and do it face-to-face. That's very difficult because when that happens, then sometimes the reaction of the voters is not very good. The voters look at you and say, what's the matter? What kind of person are you?
Yeah. Joe, why are there any underneath substantive issues, things that really divide DeWine and Taylor from each other in the Republican sphere?
Well, I think the biggest thing is Medicaid expansion. if you look at Medicaid expansion, DeWine said he's always been against it. He's never been for it. He's, you know, he says he wants to take care of the poor and that sort of thing. But he's never been for this expansion the way that it was done in Ohio. And if you look at Mary Taylor, she says, well, I was against it, but, you know, my boss was Governor Kasich, and he was for it, and so I went along with the chief on this. But the key thing is that Ohio is kind of at a situation now where the state is going to have to start putting in more money than it's been putting in the past to make that Medicaid expansion work. And a lot of lawmakers here in Columbus are questioning, you know, how to go about what, you know, how to go forward with it. Do they continue the way it's done, or do they make major changes, and how that goes? So this is a key issue for a lot of Ohioans, and it's also a key issue in this race. Mary Taylor is acknowledging that the Medicaid expansion has helped Ohio's poorest and also the most addicted in Ohio. A lot of our opiate-addicted Ohioans have benefited from the ability to use the Medicaid expansion to get services and treatment that they wouldn't have otherwise had. Mary Taylor says, well, you know, I this is helpful for that population, and she is floating a separate plan to replace the Medicaid expansion by allowing voters to vote on a bond issue, and all that money would go for that.
Okay. Let's shift over to the Democratic side. Now, in this particular situation, there are two candidates. First off, there are four different candidates, but there are two that seem to be dominant, right, Howard?
Yeah. If you, again, if you believe the polling that's out there, there are two that seem to be leading the pack. Rich Cordray, the former Ohio Attorney General, who spent the last 7 years in Washington as Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Director, the first one. And Dennis Kucinich, who has spent decades, first as the mayor of Cleveland. That didn't work out very well, but he did manage to keep his job. And as a congressman, as a presidential candidate.
Twice.
And he's been, you know, running basically forever.
So the other two, Bill O'Neill and Joe Schiavone, don't seem, at least in these polls, to have gotten a lot of traction at this point. Yeah. But, you know, again, you raised questions in our first part of our discussion about how important those polls are at this stage.
Well, and you got to remember, too, that there is a huge undecided, even in that Survey USA poll that I mentioned, you know, you're talking about 21% for Kucinich, 21% for Cordray, and single digits for the others. And that means that there are a whole bunch of Democrats out there who have yet to make up their minds. They're still looking at these people.
Joe, you're sitting in Columbus where you maybe have a better view of the entire state than we do down here. Do you see Dennis Kucinich building a run here over the last month that could actually change what the expectations going into this race were for Richard Cordray?
Definitely. Dennis Kucinich has gotten, you know, he has a name recognition as well as Cordray. But the one thing that Kucinich has is kind of a spark, a spirit when he speaks to people. He's got a following out there. There are a lot of people who like the way he talks because he's very plain spoken. And compared with Rich Cordray, who, you know, Rich is more softer spoken, more of he's very measured, and he thinks a lot about, you know, policy and that sort of thing before he, you know, answers anything. Dennis Kucinich is more of a, you know, off the cuff, can kind of give you an answer right away, and it's something that gets picked up and circulated quickly. Plus, if you look at some of the things that Dennis Kucinich has, he's getting some of these people who were formerly like Bernie voters, and he's got soon he'll have Dave Matthews of the popular Dave Matthews Band. Dave Matthews will go to Cleveland and do an acoustic set to benefit, you know, Dennis Kucinich. And that's right there in the middle of Kucinich country in Cleveland. And it'll get a lot of headlines. So there's a lot of spark and a lot of, you know, flash over on the Kucinich side that you don't see on the Cordray side. However, Cordray has a lot of support from a lot of people who have known him through the years. He has a long resume.
Howard, some of them are names that you would recognize. Elizabeth Warren, Barack Obama, people like that who could come in to Ohio.
They could.
And jump into the middle of this thing.
Howard, in a blog that you recently wrote, you focused on a problem that Cordray has, which may be it's arisen and it's a surprise mm-hmm. in the sense that the whole anti-gun
right.
situation has arisen out of what's happened from Florida and the March for Our Lives. And Richard Cordray had an A rating from the NRA when he was Attorney General of Ohio, and that's coming back to bite him a bit.
Oh, it is. And Dennis Kucinich is making an issue of it every single day in every single appearance because now in the Democratic Party, you are either against semi-automatic weapons or you're for them. And if you're for them, you're not going to get our vote. And it's almost like Cordray was gone for 7 years. And the whole political landscape changed on him. Mm-hmm. You know, suddenly he comes back here and his
yep.
some of his belief system has passed him by and as things have changed. And Kucinich seems to be out front on issues like that.
Joe, one quick question. We've only got about 30 seconds left here in this part. Do you notice anything from Cordray indicating that he's going to modify his position on guns to respond to this trend?
Well, he has come out in recent days and tried to explain it a little more clearly. But, you know, it still is a stark contrast, even when he explains it and says, you know, I was doing what I had to do as AG at that time and tries to say, you know, I agree with some home rule and this sort of thing. Even when he says that, it is still stark contrast to Dennis Kucinich.
Okay. Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio, thank you very much for your insights today. Look forward to talking to you in the future. Okay. Howard, before we take a break, I want to ask you a question about the situation at Cincinnati City Council, which we've talked a lot about in the last few weeks.
Sure.
And the council has come up with this way to approach the evaluation of the manager of Harry Black. And yet there is a problem in the sense that it all has to happen in public, seemingly. And this is a personnel issue. It's sensitive. Where do we really stand on this? Is this going to be a real problem or can they just work their way through it?
Nobody's quite sure yet at this point whether or not, you know, the system that they came up with is two council members, David Mann, Tamaya Dernard, will interview these employees who come forward to complain about Harry Black's behavior, and it will be done privately with a court reporter present and lawyers present. And then eventually it will be released to the public, to the council members, to the mayor, and to the media. Now, you can argue that that is an open process, but under the charter, the question is whether or not this is a proceeding of council or a meeting of council when these two get together. And many years ago, the city of Cincinnati lost a court case and has not had executive sessions, closed-door sessions since, never, ever. And that's exactly what this is. So but somebody is going to have to go to court and challenge it.
So your suspicion is this will end up in court?
Probably.
Okay. Before it even happens or as it happens?
Well, it could be either way. I mean, it doesn't really – they're not going to start doing the interviews until April 16th.
Okay. So there may be time to get a ruling quickly.
Maybe.
Maybe. Okay.
Nothing happens quickly. Dan, you know that.
Thank you, Howard. Okay. After the break, we shift our focus to Kentucky. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. With the heightened awareness of the damage being done by sexual harassment and sexual assault, many businesses and institutions are being tested. Last Monday, Cincinnati Inquirer reporter James Pilcher wrote a major story on the way that Northern Kentucky University handled a case of music professor Randy Pennington. Also joining us is Inquirer Education reporter Hannah Starling. If you would like to join our conversation, please call us at 513-419-7100 or email talk at WVXU, and we are on Facebook and Twitter as well. So both of you, welcome. And James, just to get started here, just a quick summary. This was not the first sexual harassment case that NKU has had to confront in the last couple of years.
No, no. Well, last year, 2 years ago, a student sued the school because there was a male student had been found internally that he had sexually assaulted her. And he was basically given the equivalent of a restraining order on campus to stay away from her. And he didn't. And the school didn't appear to do anything about it, so she sued. That turned into a major lawsuit, out of which came even more revelations about things that might have happened involving the basketball team several years ago. And the school wound up settling that case, that Title IX lawsuit, for almost $1 million. And then, you know, I wrote the story last year about the basketball team under the previous coach. Mm-hmm. To be fair, it was under a previous coach. Those players are gone, but there was major sexual impropriety and a sexual assault charge against three of the players. So fast forward to this year, and there were several sexual harassment complaints and inappropriate behavior complaints against the dean of the law school, who was then allowed – he was not found guilty of sexual misconduct, but he was found to have been basically a bully. He was allowed to resign as law school dean, but he kept his job on the faculty, and he's making almost $250,000 a year as the highest paid faculty member at NKU.
He's on leave at the moment.
He's on leave, and he will come back in the fall.
Right. Yes. And then this case that you're focused on, where a young student came in, felt she was being groomed over a series of years by her music teacher, this Randy Pennington.
Yes.
And how did the university handle this?
The university, she and three other students filed their official complaint in October. This had gone on with Natalie. She actually came forward, gave us her name.
Natalie Brady.
Right. And she was, a lot of times we'll withhold names because of the potential stigma, but she didn't care about that. She was more than willing to come forward, use her name, have her picture in the paper and all that. And so she and three other students came forward and complained officially in October. A week later, the school found, there's some stuff here, and they put him on unpaid leave. In the meantime, they then went on with their investigation. They interviewed probably 10 or 15 people. I finally got the investigatory notes and report this week after the story ran. Hmm. And so what happened was they found that he had violated the sexual conduct policy. But under state law in Kentucky and in many other states, tenure protects the professors and they're allowed what's due process. So if he had wanted to fight being fired, he could have had an administrative hearing, called in all the witnesses, including the women, to testify in front of him. And so, you know, he could have done that. But instead, they kind of informally negotiated away. He's allowed to, you know, serve out. He won't come back to campus. He's technically involuntarily resigned, but he's getting paid through the end of the semester and he's keeping his full retirement benefits. He's in his 60s. So, you know, that was the basic resolution to the case. It took, they just in mid-March announced they had done that.
Well, I guess I have a couple of questions.
Yeah.
You've touched on one of them already, the question of tenure, and maybe that's the most important. But over the course of the last 2 years, do you feel that NKU has gotten better at handling these kinds of situations? And in a sense, can other universities or businesses learn from what NKU has learned?
I can tell you, I'm not going to make a value judgment. I don't necessarily feel comfortable doing that. I can tell you that with Natalie's case, it appeared that they did a more thorough job than they did in the law school dean's case, only because the fact that I used to back that up is that they did interview, had separate interviews with all of the complaining women, several faculty members, you know, Pennington himself and all that. In the law school dean's case, his name was Jeffrey Standen.
Yeah.
They didn't even interview two of the three women who had complained. Two were students and one was not a faculty member, but she was on staff. And they didn't even try to track down or interview the two complaining students, saying they left campus, we can't track them down. Now, I found that kind of hard to believe. So, but that happened at about the same time that this one did. So it's kind of the jury's still out as to whether or not, you know, they're in transition. They've got a new, they've got an interim president in place now. They've got a new president coming in a month or two. So I think the jury's still out as to whether or not they're better or worse or whatever at it. I can tell you that, the you know, like I said, the glaring example for me was it just seemed this one, they went further than they did with the other one. And with the other one, you know,
Does the fact that law school students, by definition, are older and beyond the age of 21?
No, because once you're 18, you're considered an adult. I mean, Natalie was considered an adult when she turned 18. So it wasn't, it's not, you know, okay, you're 21, it's a different kettle of fish.
Okay.
So no, I mean, if you're a student, you're a student. Under Title IX, it doesn't matter.
Okay. So on this question of tenure.
Yes.
And of course, there's lots of issues with tenure and lots of universities are trying
which actually plays into our next segment about Kentucky's budget, which has a whole other thing with that. But go ahead.
What's your view or what's the discussion at NKU about the value of tenure at the same time as the Me Too movement and the heightened awareness of the need to be responsive to women who are being
I don't think it's necessarily just an NKU issue. I think
I don't think it is either.
I did talk to, you know, NKU. The sense I got from the officials there was they were doing their best to file. They got two conflicting laws. Basically, you got the Title IX law. You have the country's federal enforcement of law, sexual harassment laws, and you have tenure. The tenure rules, which provide almost a protected class for a certain set of professors. You stay there long enough, you do enough work, you're guaranteed a job for life. That's basically the way it works. So now I think this is a conversation that started to happen all over the country in academia, in that how much protection do we want to give professors who act badly? Mm-hmm. So I get, you know, where you go from there, that's something that the state legislatures have to take up because it's in the state laws. So you got to go to that level. I mean, they're protected by state law in these rules. So that's kind of the conversation. And that certainly is starting to bubble up as this becomes a more public issue as the Me Too movement grows, especially on campuses.
And it's not just about in relationship to this issue, but tenure itself. Universities are trying to find ways of reducing the number of people who have tenure, and there's all sorts of policy issues involved, and it's kind of messy at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
On all sorts of things.
And it even gets into a budgetary issue. If you've allowed a bunch of professors to achieve tenure and you have to keep paying them,
right,
and you're getting, like in Kentucky's case, a 6% across the board higher education cut in the overall state budget. Your hands kind of. What are you doing? I mean, there was a proposal in the General Assembly, in the last session, to allow the firing of tenured professors for budgetary reasons, which raises a whole nother legal set of issues. Right. So,
well, we can get to some of those.
Absolutely.
So, take a break right now. James Pilcher and Hannah Sparling are staying put right here in the studio. After the break, we are broadening our Kentucky focus to look at what's happening in Frankfort. As this session of the state legislature winds up its work, it has lots of teachers very concerned. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The Kentucky legislature is completing its work on the state budget and on pension reform. James Pilcher and Hannah Sparling of the Cincinnati Enquirer are with me here in the studio. Joining us are political writer for the Lexington Herald Leader, Daniel DeRocher, and the Kentucky State House reporter for the Louisville Courier Journal, is Tom Loftus. Welcome, everyone, to Cincinnati Edition this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tom, just to get started, how would you say, what sort of is the status that we are in? What's happening in Frankfurt behind the scenes? What are the push points? What are people trying to work out before the legislature comes back?
Limbo would be a good word for it, Dan. For the most part, the Republicans who run the House and Senate hope, at least, that the game is largely over. They've sent the governor a pension bill, a budget, and a tax bill. The tax bill passed by the bare minimum number of votes needed. And while the governor has praised them for the pension bill, he has said the tax and budget bills are fiscally irresponsible. His statement of earlier this week did not say whether or not he would veto them. But I think they're surely expecting some line items in the budget to be vetoed and probably the tax bill to be vetoed. He has basically until a week from today to make his decisions on those vetoes. So I think there's a fair amount of uncertainty as to what the governor will do. And there's probably a lot of nervousness among leaders who'd like to hold to these bills, which were very hard for them to get through the House and Senate. The tax bill passed by the bare minimum number of votes, 51 votes in the 100-member House and 20 votes in the 38-member Senate to get to the governor. They'd need to hold all of those votes to override any veto of the tax bill by the governor.
Daniel DeRocher from Lexington Herald Leader. With the tax bill, what are the controversial points? What has the legislature passed that the governor, Governor Bevin, finds irresponsible?
So he didn't offer too many specifics on what exactly he found irresponsible in terms of the tax bill, but he kind of just offered this broad stroke of he thinks it's irresponsible to increase taxes in order to pay for more spending. So it's kind of this philosophical argument that he's making. Because really what the tax bill does is it needs to raise revenue to support a lot of the education priorities that the House set forth in their budget. And they did that by lowering the income tax and expanding the sales tax. And so the governor has kind of said that we need to modernize our tax base. We need to do comprehensive tax reform. And in general, that's the type of tax reform that he would be in support of, right? Like he wants to lower the income tax, increase the sales tax, and broaden the base. But it seems like he feels that they did. I'm not in his head, so I can't say exactly what he feels like he did. But it seems like he wanted a more comprehensive tax reform, one that did it in a kind of bigger way than the incremental tax reform that the House of Representatives and the Senate did.
James Pilcher here from the Inquirer. How about the Northern Kentucky delegation? Where do representatives from this area of the state, where do they fall, and are there one or two that have particular influence in the debate that's going on?
Well, they fall pretty much along party lines. There's really only two Democrats from the Northern Kentucky delegation, Dennis Keene, House member, very senior House member from the Newport area, the Newport District, and Arnold Simpson out of Covington.
This is his last.
Yeah, and he's already announced he's going to step down. So that's right. Going to be a very hotly contested race as the Democrats try to hold on and maybe even grow and overcome their deficit, or the Republicans try. Mm-hmm. And as we know, Northern Kentucky has turned increasingly red. But when you talk about influential, Senator Chris McDaniel, who is in our Northern Kentucky delegation. He actually runs the Finance and Revenue Committee for the Senate. So he was very, very involved in creating both tax reform and budget. So when it comes to a lot of this and the teacher stuff, it has fallen clearly along party lines. But And we'll get into the teacher stuff a little bit. But
very soon.
Yeah, they're having to justify a lot of what they're doing. And Representative Keene has actually been one of the leading voices on how regressive, potentially regressive, this new system with fees and sales tax can be on lower income people. So that's been the Democrats' main argument statewide, is that by switching to this kind of revenue system, you're going to penalize the lower income people, lower income taxpayers more than you will the higher income, because it doesn't matter as much to them.
Right.
You know, obviously that's a philosophical argument,
right.
but that's where he's been.
But what we do have right now is a Republican controlled legislature, both houses, in disagreement with the Republican governor.
Yeah,
so
who
it's
I
not
think,
just the Democrats.
And you know what Dan was saying earlier. You know, being in Matt Bevin's head would be a scary place, but you know, I think what he's saying, what Bevin is saying to the legislature, you didn't go far enough. I promised my constituents this, and you're giving me a warmed over version of this, which we know is how the sausage is made anyway, right? So that's the philosophical difference. What's going on?
Well, Hannah, let's get to. What is maybe the emotional center of all of this, and that is the teachers.
Yeah.
And the teachers, Kentucky teachers, seemingly a week ago at this point, found themselves in a situation sort of like Oklahoma or West Virginia, and now it's kind of gone quiet for a week.
Yeah, the teachers.
What's going on here?
Kind of, I guess, just like the House and the Senate, they're in limbo a little bit. I know they're still very, very unhappy, kind of waiting to see what happens. So the bill that went through the House and the Senate was a little bit of a reprieve for them. So they got some things the governor had proposed cutting. They got those back in. But I know they—
What were things that they wanted back in?
There was a lot of transportation funding that was shifted to them that's been put back on the state. Some programs that were going to be cut that it looks like now maybe they won't be cut. But they feel, just kind of throughout the process, really, really disrespected. And, like, there are these things that are having a huge impact on them, but they're not getting a seat at the table. And I know they're also pretty fearful of what Governor Bevin might do with his line item veto.
Right. And I know that, you know, one of the big besides the pension issue, one of the big sticking points is, I think, statewide. Tom, back me up on this number, that the overall state allocation per student is going to go down by 10-15%, something like that. I know that's a big thing for them, for the teachers. But then, of course, the pension issue is the biggest one.
The state funding for per pupil funding for teachers is going to go up in this final budget. It does not go up as much as it would have in the House version of the budget earlier this session. But basically, Governor Bevin and the Senate versions of the budget would have kept it flat. The final budget gives it a nice little increase over that. That's what the tax increase is largely all about. It funds a little increase in per pupil funding and also restore some funding that would have been cut in the budget on student transportation and health insurance for district employees that the governor's original budget proposal would have shifted back to the school districts. So while it's not a generous or great public school budget, it's certainly not one that was as draconian as proposed by the governor earlier this session. It's under the circumstances, given the difficulty of passing any taxes, it's a pretty good education budget.
Daniel, what's being said here is it, and we've seen this same thing in Ohio, in order to make the state budget work, trying to push more costs back on the local units, in this case, the local school district. Is that part of what's happening here?
I mean, that was what kind of the original proposal was. It was going to make school districts pick up more of the cost. This budget, like Tom said, the reason for the increase in revenue, the reason that they felt like they needed to increase taxes was so that they could continue to support education funding kind of at the level that they are now and boost it a little bit. So they're still cutting some programs, they're still reducing some costs for the state, but in this time where you have this massively underfunded pension liability, and then you also have kind of stagnant revenue, they needed to do something to try and bring more money in. That being said, they are kind of pushing a few of the costs back onto school districts. School districts are going to have to pick up, I think, 3% of some of the costs for, if I don't remember exactly, but there was something that the school districts are going to have to pay a little bit more for. So they're going to shift some, but you have to understand that there are a lot of school districts that are barely making ends meet in a lot of counties in Kentucky. So while Jefferson County schools or Fayette County schools may be doing fine, some of these small, especially coal communities that are kind of, they're losing a lot of tax revenue, they're really struggling. And so to push those costs back onto those districts, those schools would likely face, they would face a huge budget issue, and it would be difficult to educate students.
And don't forget, Dan, that this is reliving a battle that was fought back in the 90s. They centralized most of school funding in Kentucky, which was never done in Ohio.
That's what I was just going to have.
Yeah, I mean,
Anna remind us of.
Right. It's like, you know, the Ohio, they rely on these local school levies and everything else, and the courts have routinely found it unconstitutional, but they keep doing it. They had that fight back in the 90s in Kentucky, and now we're going back to that, potentially back to that system, which could lead to more court fights. So it's, you know.
And I think also another thing I'm hearing is that while it's gotten a little better for school districts, the argument I think that Democrats are making, at least, is that the tax shift here will push the burden onto maybe some more lower-income families. And these teachers are saying, well, hey, wait a minute, those are my families. And so schools already do so much in the way of making up where families fall short and buying food and buying clothing. And so if families are struggling more with that, it means school districts have to do more.
There was just a study that showed that 95% of the population would see a tax increase from this bill. And so that's kind of the argument that Democrats are making, is that when you're expanding the sales tax, especially on things like cigarettes and auto repairs, you're going to disproportionately affect some of the more low-income families that have to use those services.
And it isn't just even sales taxes. They're putting fees. It's going to be a fee-based system on a lot of services that are, you know, lawn services, things like that. So it's
well let's talk about the pension, the underfunded pension problem, because that drives a lot of this. And if I'm correct, we've got Kentucky has a huge underfunded pension, and they have to do something.
It's one of the worst in the country.
So Hannah, what do the teachers want? What is the legislature trying to do? And where is the governor in all of this?
And I think the teachers want to go back in time a couple of days and undo the bill that was passed. It seems like that's maybe a done deal for them. Their fear and their worry is that I think most of the teachers now feel like they're probably okay and they'll be okay for the future. They're worried it's going to damage the profession in the future, and that younger teachers are going to say, you know, why would I go to Kentucky if I can get a better deal in a different state?
And
yeah, because it does away for pensions for anybody that joins the system after July. If the bill passes, they don't get a pension. They're in a hybrid 401k like they have for public employees, right? So they don't get a pension anymore, which is one of the huge benefits of being a public employee. You take that away, Kentucky becomes a less attractive place for a teacher to work.
Now,
and it also eliminates the the inviolable contract for those new teachers. So while this cash balance plan is an okay cash balance plan that the future teachers might be getting, there's no guarantee that they will continue to get that in the future. And the legislature or future legislature could come back and say, no, we're going to scrap that. We think you – or give them a less generous plan.
You mean new teachers are at risk of that, or all teachers?
Yeah, so new teachers would lose the inviolable contract.
And so
the people who are hired after, like next year in 2019, they would not have the inviolable contract. So a future legislature could come in
for
and
new
switch
teachers,
them over to a 401.
They would get a less generous cash balance hybrid plan, and there's no guarantee that the terms of those of that plan would not be worsen through the years because they would not have the inviolable contract.
And I'm glad you brought
into the future. And that's the big rub against this bill is that, as I guess it was James pointed out, that it makes teaching a much less attractive profession down the line. And what would that mean for Kentucky?
Well, let me ask this question. Tom or Daniel or Hannah, I don't know. Have any of you talked to people in the ed schools at UK or the University of Louisville about what the discussion's going on with their students right now who are going to be on the job market? What are they telling their students? Are they telling them, especially in an area like this, where we're right across the river, where Ohio's right across the river, does, you know, there are options here.
And I haven't talked with the teachers teaching the teachers at the colleges, but I did have a middle school teacher in Covington tell me that she teaches fourth grade, I believe, and she's got students now who say to her, hey, I want to be like you when I grow up. I want to be a teacher. And she said, I'll have to tell them to go somewhere else because it's not worth it to stay here.
Yeah. Tom, Daniel, have you talked to anybody? Have you been in touch with the teacher side of this in your communities?
What Hannah pointed out is a common statement made by the thousands of teachers who've been through Frankfort in the last few weeks in general about the outlook for the profession. But specifically, I haven't talked to anybody in the schools at UK or U of L.
And I know that Daniel brought up the inviolable contract, as did Tom, which brings us back. And I know that in your last segment, Howard said that the city hall is going to wind up in court. This one's going to wind up in court too, because the attorney general, Steve Beshear, has already said he's going to sue, because even the changes they're making, the minor changes they're making to existing teachers, violates that contract, violates that inviolable contract clause of the pension system. So this is going to wind up in court too.
So
he's also going to end up suing because of a weird law that they may have broken when they passed the bill. They were supposed to get, according to the state statute, they were supposed to get an actuarial analysis on this pension bill before they passed it out of committee, and they just completely disregarded that statute. And so it's likely that the attorney general said that he's also going to challenge the bill on that statute as well.
Did they disregard it because they didn't want to hear it?
They were... they didn't. I guess they brought it out with too little time to get an actual actuarial analysis on what this would do to the Kentucky teachers' retirement system, and so they just kind of rushed it through. The chairman of the committee, Jerry Miller, when confronted with the fact that it would violate the statute, was just like, "Well, I don't care. We're going to pass this anyways because it needs to be heard on the floor."
And don't forget, so they passed this in the middle of the night, attached to a sewer bill. So
yeah, and that was all. Like, so it got brought out in committee at like 2:30. On pretty much the second to last day.
It was a former sewer bill. I mean, once they took the sewer stuff out, it wasn't a sewer bill.
I don't think that matters much to the teachers.
So what do you think, am I correct that a lot of teachers, at least in our Kentucky teachers in Northern Kentucky, have been on vacation this week? Is that true?
A lot of schools are on spring break right now, and there's a lot of theories about maybe that's why they waited until now to do it. But there were some that were not, and there were sick outs across the state. Friday and then Monday and Tuesday, teachers just called in and said, we're not coming to school today. We're going to go protest in Frankfort.
So do you see that re-energizing now, or do you see it sort of as that's been spent?
It's definitely not done. I think we are waiting to see, and a lot of it hinges on what line item vetoes come out of this. But I think as teachers in Kentucky look around at West Virginia and Oklahoma, they're saying, hey, there's momentum behind this right now, and people are paying attention.
There's a bunch of teachers that have already applied to run for office. There's like 30 of them in the state of Kentucky alone. So
remember, in November was a common chant and a common sign on Monday.
So there may be more to come on this discussion. Mm-hmm. But just to close this out, just so I'm clear, when will Governor Bevin announce his line item vetoes, and if he vetoes the full tax bill or whatever, when will that happen?
He has until midnight April 13th,
okay,
which is a week from today, to decide what he'll veto, whether he'll veto the tax bill or whether he'll veto the budget bill or items in the budget bill. He surely will at least veto some items in the budget bill. Whether he vetoes the bills in their entirety, we won't know until then. He could act on it as soon as today, but he has until then, and the legislature plans on meeting a week from tomorrow on Saturday for the session's final day to consider any veto, overriding any vetoes that they get.
And just for the sake of our Ohio listeners, where legislature runs very differently, Saturday will be it? That's it for the term?
Yes, that is
the session is limited by Constitution to 60 days, and next Friday and Saturday are days 59 and 60.
Okay. I want to thank all of my guests this afternoon. We've covered a lot of territory, and in an agreement that was unveiled this morning, it looks like FC Cincinnati will build a soccer stadium in the West End. WVXU reporter Bill Reinhart joins us with what you've discovered today, and I know you've been all over the city trying to figure this one out.
Yes. Well, let's back up a bit. On Wednesday of this week, the Cincinnati Public Schools had a closed-door meeting, an executive session, to talk about matters related to the sale of property. And that was, of course, talking about the land swap that had been – it seemed to be dead in the water last month with FC Cincinnati over Stargell Stadium. Well, it's not dead in the water, and apparently it is a zombie. It's back. It's back on life. Back. It's not even on life support. It's now got a lot of support. Let's just say that. This morning, Councilman P.G. Sittenfeld and David Mann announced they are introducing a development agreement at the next council meeting that will help get that stadium built in the West End. Cincinnati Public Schools says yes, we have received an offer from FC Cincinnati that does appear to meet all of our terms that we agreed to last month. So now it looks like it's going to go forward.
So agreed to all of the terms that were put forward last month. The big question there was how much tax they were going
property
to pay.
Property taxes. And
what are they willing
PG
to pay?
Sittenfeld says this is going to make CPS whole. It's going to mean FC Cincinnati pays all of their property taxes. The city will not be paying in lieu. They will not be contributing to that. It will all come from the team.
So, in other words, the school board holding out.
School board held out.
Demanding that they get paid everything. They've actually, in the end, taken it all the way to the top. They were going to get $70,000 a year.
Yes.
And now is it $200,000 basically?
Or
$2
million. It's something like that. They are getting what they asked for. They're also going to get academic and athletic programs with the team. The community development or the community benefits agreement is going to be worked out over the coming weeks should this all go forward.
Well, that's the question I had next, which was the community benefits agreement, which is not with the schools and not with the city government, but with the community of the West End.
Yes.
That's a whole nother process.
Another layer in the layer cake. And this agreement does seem to have the approval of the West End Community Council Board President, if not every member of the board or all the residents. His name is Keith Blake. He was at the press conference this morning. He calls the deal the beginning of a bright future for the neighborhood.
So apparently this is not just city school board and FC Cincinnati. There's the third party is also involved in this.
It does have some neighborhood support. It's got its detractors still, but it does have some support.
James, you're still sitting here. What's your observation on this one?
Well, I do, according to what I've learned about the deal, it will take $38 million out of city tax money, but it's not like out of the general budget or city taxpayers.
That'll be the infrastructure.
Right. It's to pay for the infrastructure. It's $33 million. Some of that will help make the thing whole, but you got TIF money and all that. So there's taxpayers' money involved in this.
Okay. Well, thanks, Bill, James, Hannah. Whew, we've covered a lot of territory this afternoon. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Pete Reitmeier, assistant producer Selena Reeder, and the technical director is Josh Elstrow.